I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
All right, welcome to Red, White, and Brews. I'm Greg Grugan, and it happened, my dream job. I'm actually getting paid to drink beer and talk to people I like, respect, and fascinated by, and I've got a good one today.
Cheers.
Congressman Dan Crenshaw.
How you doing?
Thanks for being here, man.
Thanks for having me.
In case you guys don't know, Dan Crenshaw, Texan, lived in South America as a kid. He's fluent in Spanish, decorated Navy SEAL, wounded in service of our country, came back, went to Harvard for graduate school, and came home to represent us in Congress. And you know, he's done a lot of great work ever since. I'm proud to have covered his first race. I saw his resume, and I said, like, I got to meet this guy. We met out in Cyprus. He was helping folks recover from Harvey, and I interviewed him. I was a one-man band with a camera. He was standing in front of a debris pile, and I said, this guy has got it going on. You remember that, Dan?
I do. Before I even wanted to run, actually, I came back home to volunteer for Team Rubicon. Familiar with them? They do good work. I mean, it's we're just mucking out houses like all day long. You know, it's just it's all you can do, right? To help people out. So I felt good. I had no intention of being in politics at that time, actually. So our interview must have occurred way later than that, because there's obviously still debris, because we decided to run, I think, in November. But, you know, there was still a lot of damage.
It was a packed race. You fought into a runoff, and it was the last time we had a beer together was at your victory party, which I was covering.
Yeah. That was good times.
It was a long time ago.
Politics was fun back then.
Hey, I've been watching your social media, and you're a pretty serious guy. You've got a good sense of humor, but it's wry. But I have enjoyed watching your face, the soft side of Dan Crenshaw with his two-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
What's going on there, man?
Oh, she is the best. Susie. So her name is, her full name is, first name is actually Susan Arabella. Susan after my mom. So I lost my mom when I was 10. We were living in Katy at the time and lost her to cancer. So I've always wanted to name my first daughter Susan, but you know, Susie's such a cute name, and she looks like a Susie. Arabella, it was like a part of the name my wife wanted, because it's a restaurant at the bottom of the Vail Mountain where I taught her to ski. And so it's special. Susan Arabella, Susie. And today, I mean, she's a handful. So she just turned 2 on September 12th. And today, while I was out, I had a million events today. I just spoke at 2 high schools. I love going to high schools, hearing questions, and talking to kids. Even though they can't vote, like I think it's so important we do that. My wife calls me frantically. I'm in another meeting. And she's like, yeah. So me and Susie were outside. You know, because Susie loves to be outside. Yeah. We have a pool. She loves to be in the pool. And then she went inside, pushed a chair up to the back door, reached up and pulled our like ultra security deadbolt. So there's like the deadbolt that like Tara could type in a code in,
right,
and unlock. But Susie got the other deadbolt, which you cannot get past that.
She's two.
Tara's like, can you, like, what can we do? Because the front door was also deadbolted with the same kind of deadbolt, just for their own, like, she had it already. Luckily, I can open the garage with my phone, and luckily she got back in, so it's all good. Justice. But that's like the level of 2-year-old we are dealing with. She is a genius. Maybe every parent says that about their kid, but I don't know. I mean, she's so much fun, and she just, you know, she's gonna run me through the ringer. I know that.
You seem like you're digging it. It's good.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, everyone's like, oh, they're going to have your daughter. They're going to have you wrapped around her finger. I'm like, yeah, no, of course.
Perfect.
That's what a daughter is. Yes. My princess. Of course.
Hey man, I'm going to switch gears pretty quickly because, you know, I follow your work. It's part of my job. And you kind of been at the tip of the spear on attacking the cartels. You know, you unabashedly called them an existential threat on our border. You are heading a special task force in Congress. Give us the latest. What's going on? Because we've been seeing some pretty heavy anti-cartel activity.
Yeah, in the Caribbean, against mostly from the Venezuelan side. You know, the next step is really the heart of the cartels, of course, are in Mexico. That's where the real power structure is. And I think we're moving in the right direction in a huge way. We've got a lot of things. It's like a perfect storm. So you got Trump in the White House, who is making this a priority. And you've also got a different administration in Mexico. Sheinbaum, same party, same Morena party, same kind of left-wing socialist stuff, but they are very different when it comes to cooperation with the United States on intelligence sharing and hopefully future operations together. I've developed what I think is a pretty solid counter-narco strategy. I've literally sat down with Pete Hegseth, Secretary of War, about it. We've edited it together. I mean, this is the depth that we're getting into. Cash Patel, FBI director, CIA director, John Ratcliffe, Ambassador to Mexico, Ron Johnson, State Department. We are all on the same page, moving together with a strategy. Number one part of that strategy was a diplomatic breakthrough, because you have to have some kind of big meeting in Mexico or in D.C. where we are like, hey, we're going to do this together. And guess what happened a couple of weeks ago? One of our greatest secretaries of state, I'm not just blowing smoke here, Marco Rubio is amazing. And he was just down in Mexico, met with President Sheinbaum. They talked about this exact thing. And so honestly, at this point, Congress is behind. So I've developed the legislation. We're kind of past the task force at this point. I've been meeting with the speaker's office to say, hey, look, we need to get these different pieces of legislation to support the administration's efforts into the right committees of jurisdiction, and let's move forward.
Hold that thought. Red, White, and Brews will be right back.
I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
Welcome back to Red, White, and Brews. My friend and guest, Congressman Dan Crenshaw, we were talking about the ongoing effort to push back on an existential threat, the Mexican cartels. In our discussions, you have talked extensively about enabling in a real way the Mexican government to do what they've really wanted to do for a long time, which was to eradicate an internal threat.
Yeah. Well, let's get another beer for that conversation, please, because it's complicated. The only correction I'll make in what you said is what they really want to do for a long time. So it's actually the problem we've been having with Mexico for a very long time is that they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Or at least they don't want our help in doing it. So, you know, compare the situation in Mexico to Colombia. I spent my high school years in Colombia. My dad was working for Houston Oil or Baker Oil Tools, right? Or a Houston oil family. And Plan Colombia came out in 2000 under George Bush. And so for 25 years, we're basically working side by side. Well, actually before that too. I mean, you know, you watch the show Narcos, working side by side with the Colombians, with sharing intelligence, working with them, training them, getting them the things they need to beat back the insurgency and the guerrillas that were then taking over the country. And it's a much safer country now than it used to be. It works. If you're committed, it works. We've never had that kind of commitment with Mexico, and that's not our fault. That's the Mexican government saying, no, no, no. You know, we remember when you invaded, and we're like, when was that? The 1840s. We're like, the 1840s? But that is literally on like the populist political mind of Mexico. So you have to understand there's a huge cultural difference there. So it's been difficult. That's why that first step was diplomatic breakthrough. The situation's gotten so bad, they realize it, and they know, look, we need this. Because, I mean, more of them are dying than us. I mean, the Mexican people are terrorized by these groups, absolutely terrorized. But we've woken up to it because of the fentanyl. You know, that's killing tens of thousands of Americans. So now there's this, again, a perfect storm where it's like, hey, we got to do something. So what does that look like? Like, if I have my way, what does it look like? Well, it looks a lot like Plan Colombia, but I would say on steroids.
Right.
It's when you're fighting what is effectively a counterinsurgency war, and you are enabling your partner force, which is the Mexican government, to destroy the enemy. Now, this is difficult because it's an insurgency. The narcos are embedded in every level of society, from the local police to the state governments, to pop culture. You know, you talk about narco corridos. That's like a form of song. It's like gangster rap for them. I mean, it's literally part of their culture. They have like death cult worships. I mean, look at the Santa Muerte. Like, that's a symbolism that like where you know, like, okay, these are cartel members. So it's a real problem. It's almost religious in like in that sense. And so what do you do? I mean, what does it look like? It looks like us, you know, special operations working side by side with their special operations, training them, bringing them to the United States to get better training, giving them the tools they need. What are those tools? Black Hawk helicopters, close air support. When they go on an operation in rural Mexico against sicarios that have 50 cal machine guns and up armored F-150 trucks because they have all the money in the world, and this has happened. I'm talking about like a real op. They get surrounded. Like these some of the elite Mexican special forces are very good, and we've worked with them. They're very good, but there's only like a few hundred of them, and well, they'll go and they'll be surrounded. Now, if the Navy SEALs are surrounded by a bunch of bad guys on an op like that, what do? We just call in close air support, and all the bad guys are dead. AC-130 gunship hits them all with 30 mic rounds or a Predator or whatever the case is. They don't have any of that. They need it. And so, look, this isn't rocket science. There is a methodology to actually beating this back, and we just need to walk through that door if they're going to open it for us.
You know, that's from a tactical sense. From a strategic sense, what about, you know, attacking their ability to shift money around?
Absolutely part of the strategy. One of the hardest parts of the strategy. They use a lot of ways to shift money around. So they use trade-based money laundering, where the money never moves. The Chinese have a lot to do with that because the Chinese need money in the United States because they can't, but they have a rule in China. They can't take out $50,000. So there's this whole like exchange of goods. It's almost like the hawala system, but in Mexico. So there's that. There's Bitcoin. Bitcoin's easier to track actually because, you know, there's a ledger. But still, actually, what we found is that the bulk of it is still just cash. And what we need to do, part of our strategy, we need to be looking at southbound inspections as well, not just stuff coming up into our country, but weapons and money going back down to Mexico. And we need what those called non-intrusive inspection technologies. That's what we have them. We use them. But they're incredibly ineffective at detecting fentanyl because it's so small. But they're very effective at detecting bigger things like cash and weapons. So that definitely has to be part of the strategy.
Look, the big difference is the guy in the White House. I know you've had face-to-face conversations with Donald Trump about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
He's tapped you as an expert. What kind of difference is he making here? Everything?
A huge difference. I mean, like, I don't blame Biden too much because Biden didn't have a partner in Mexico,
yeah.
Right? AMLO, President AMLO was not a partner at all. They wanted to deny that fentanyl was even made in Mexico. I mean, you didn't have anyone to talk to. We were still doing some pretty good intelligence sharing and that kind of thing, but it's improved a ton under President Trump. I guess President Trump has made it a priority. And so by designating them as terrorists, what that actually did was really wake up the military. Now, the military still had the authorities it needed to tackle this problem. But when you call something a terrorist, the military just sort of wakes up. It's like a cultural shift. And so NORTHCOM, which is the combatant command in charge of Canada, the United States, and Mexico, because Mexico is part of North America, according to how we label it, and that's how they see themselves too. We are in full planning mode in a way that was never taking place before. So that's because of President Trump. He said, you're going to do this. The FBI is all over it. I mean, every agency gets the problem. I've talked to all of them. They get the problem. They understand what needs to be done. Actually, my biggest hurdle is getting members of Congress down there to learn about the problem to get it done, because we are now falling behind as members of Congress because we need to fund and authorize some of these things that Trump needs to be able to do to be successful.
All right, man. We're going to talk some more Red, White, and Bruise. We'll be right back. I pledge allegiance. Welcome back to Red, White, and Bruise with my special guest, Congressman Dan Crenshaw. Hey, Dan, you know, I think I would, you know, people would go crazy if I didn't ask you, you know, about your thoughts regarding the political assassination of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts are, where do I even begin? I mean, you know, he was a friend. He was one of the first people to platform me. I did so much work with him at TPUSA. What I want people to know about Charlie because I think people see him as this like provocateur, this activist. And what I want, you know, his kids aren't going to get to know him. They're 1 and 4 years old. This is, it's tragic on so many levels. And so I'm going to say it as many times as I can on the air. Every time I'm asked about this is, I want his kids to know that he was not a provocateur or activist. I mean, yes, I mean, technically he's an activist, right? To create an activist organization, but he was an intellectual. I have not, I mean, and look at, you know, go on the internet and find the clips, especially the long form stuff he does, like the podcasts and everything. His ability to explain Christian theology, to explain the American origins of law, a lot of the things I like doing, right? It's like kind of why we got along. Because I like to teach people things about our founding, and that's what he did too. He could, he better than I could. He was like, he was better, more well read than I was, if I'm being honest. He could talk to you about the origins and the authors and the philosophers of Marxist and socialist ideology, like how Herbert Marcuse like developed this kind of identity politics complex and Kimberly Crenshaw and all that. And then he could also talk to you about how the founders, what the founders wrote, like which Bible verses they referenced to inform themselves of how to create the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. This was not just an activist spouting out random slogans. This was a guy who knew conservatism. And he fought for it, and he went, and he went to the places where it was uncomfortable to go, where people would yell at him and smear him and do it. But he did it, and he did it kindly. You know, he's like painted as this like evil guy, and I'm like, show me the part where he's evil. Show me the quote. And they do, right? And then it turns out it's totally taken out of the context, right? It's just a lie. Like, he really lived by his Christian values. A lot of people don't. You know, he did.
Look, what I've always respected about you is your willingness to meet anyone in the public square, anywhere, for an exchange of ideas and a civil debate.
Yeah.
You know.
And he did too. That was him. I mean, that was him through and through, going to these places and spark the debate. I mean, I'm not going to get the quote right, but, you know, he had said at one point, like, when we stop talking, that's when we start. That's when the violence starts. When we stop talking.
Well, the violence here, you know, has an element of something that you saw as a clear and present danger to America at large and got involved with on a legislative level, which was the proliferation, the legitimization of a lot of the pre-18-year-old transitioning that was happening in this country as healthcare.
Yeah, the gender transitioning of minors. And obviously, Charlie was very outspoken on this. I mean, I've always been out. We all are. Because it's crazy. Because it's absolutely crazy and it's against all the science. And, you know, it appears that Charlie's killer was indeed a trans activist. Now, was Charlie anti-trans? Well, I can show, I mean, the clips are out there. Like, he's been asked about this plenty of times. And why do you hate trans people? And he's like, I have no hate. He could be friends with a trans person. I could be friends with a trans person. I just don't think that you should be transitioning a minor. And also, if you want to be a trans person, be who you want to be, but also don't expect taxpayers to fund it. That's literally our only policy. I don't think you should be able to serve in the military simply because medically it's just not feasible. I can't serve in the military because I'm missing an eye. Okay, which is arguably less severe of a condition than an entire gender transformation. That's all we're talking about. We're not crazy people and we're not hateful at all. And Charlie was not. And like, I remember there's another clip of him where he like actually yells at a right wing supporter because he's talking about this right winger was like, you know, saying just something about like how Charlie wasn't Christian enough or something. And Charlie hammered him for being hateful. Like, Charlie was not hateful, you know, and it's just so sad. There's so many things said about him that are just not true, and it's up to us to get that truth out. And for my part, I respected him as an intellectual. One of the last conversations we had was I was giving him some props because I was like, I just heard this podcast he did was debating very thoughtfully a socialist, like a very academic socialist. It was a really good podcast, like both of them very respectful. And I was like, Charlie, do more of this, man. This is like you at your best. And he was like, Dan, thanks. That means a lot to me. And, you know, that was we texted a bunch since then. But like that was, I think, one of our last meaningful conversations. And, you know, all that's going to happen now is that that movement is going to get stronger.
Yeah. I mean, he was a proponent of conversations of depth and meaning and transformation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'll be remembered, you know, he was a good man.
I think fondly. Yeah. Cause he lived by his values and no one can prove otherwise.
Hey, how's your dad? Real quick.
He's good. He's good. You know, my parents are doing well. Replaced his shoulder finally. So, you know, he's doing well. He's looking young. They're having a good time.
It's my way of giving him a shout out.
They're enjoying babysitting my lovely daughter.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. All right, man. Red, White, and Brews is around now. Will you come back?
Absolutely. We got to do it longer. Make it a podcast. You know, we had a ton of topics we missed.
All right. It'll take a 12-pack.
Yeah, it will.
All right. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And I hope you come back to Red, White, and Brews. I pledge allegiance.